This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Texas is roasting in triple-digit heat week after week. Canada is still on fire. Heat blisters break out all over the world, including India and China, going beyond human endurance. Oceans have never been so hot, at least in the Northern Hemisphere. Where are we, and what is happening? Paul Beckwith is the Canadian scientist who tracks extreme climate change. He taught climate science at Canadian universities. Paul reported for Radio EcoShock from the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow. He makes science simple for the rest of us on his popular YouTube channel. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and it's been a while for us.
It has been a while. It's just been so hectic trying to keep up with the climate science and with events predicted for years that are happening now. How has the air been in Ottawa lately?
We had our first taste of the very, very unhealthy air from the wildfire smoke back on June 6th was the first day. So it was a big deal for Ottawa because Ottawa has very little industry and the air quality is always exceptional here, or usually exceptional. So June 6th was bad, and then but June 7th broke all records. I think at that point, Ottawa was the most polluted city in the world. On the air quality index, the U.S. air quality index, we reached 511. And that's the PM2.5 particles, particulate matter 2.5 micron diameter and smaller, are very unhealthy because they're so small they can get deep inside the body and even into the bloodstream eventually, cause all kinds of inflammation and harm. Those levels were over 500 micrograms per cubic meter. Now, to give you an idea, they say that 22 micrograms per cubic meter is equivalent to smoking one cigarette. So that was a well over a pack in that day for anybody that was outside, you know, men, women, or children, elderly, youth. Everybody was basically smoking over a pack of cigarettes that day. And same with Montreal. There's a very good chance that Montreal will get hit with this. And then, you know, a day or two out, it's going to be on the East Coast again. I think Boston is in the crosshairs right now. I mean, New York might miss the worst of it. So there's nothing that's gone down with the wildfires. There's more fires. They're sending more smoke. They're burning more area. It's just that the wind directions haven't been blowing the smoke into Canadian cities in the last little while. It stayed mostly up north, and it's gone across the Atlantic Ocean into Europe. So I know Ireland and Scotland and Spain, you know, it was going into countries like that. And exceptionally bad. I mean, it's the air currents can sometimes refocus the particles. And I know when on June 7th, New York was hit. Well, Ottawa was hit June 7th. New York was hit a day or two later, and New York was a lot worse than Ottawa was in terms of, it looked like, or Mars. The sky was just orange and very, very difficult to breathe.
Yeah, this is really a global event. The EU's Copernicus satellite monitoring system just sent me a notice that Canadian wildfire smoke has officially reached Europe. People are underestimating what this means. Now, wildfires are made more likely by climate change. That makes sense. But can they also be a driver for more warming in themselves?
Absolutely, because they wipe out a strong sink of carbon. I mean, the boreal forest, which circumvents the planet in the Northern Hemisphere, is a vital sink for carbon dioxide. You know, as we burn more and more of the wild areas of the boreal forest, not only do you release the carbon, you know, while the fires are going on, but there's no absorption of the carbon anymore from the atmosphere. So you really, the ability of the forest to absorb carbon is greatly reduced. So CO2 levels will definitely go up in the atmosphere. You also get the smoke from the fires. It can actually travel right up into the Arctic and fall and darken the snow and ice up there, which leads to a very strong melting feedback because the darker surface absorbs a lot more sunlight. So this is a huge problem too. And what people don't talk about, I mean, forest fire is a bit of a misnomer because in the boreal forest, about 80% of the fuel that is burning is actually It's the peatlands on the ground. It's the litter on the surface floor that's fallen branches and trees and needles, et cetera. And it's also the permafrost underneath that is starting to, you know, warm up and ignite. So 80% of that smoke is basically from the ground floor of the forest. I mean, the trees are also burning, you know, up to the crowns, but most of the smoke is from, you know, the moss and all the stuff that's on the surface of the forest.
Ooh, when you talk about peat fires, you kind of send a chill down my spine. In 1997, 98, there were huge peat fires in Indonesia. It buried Asia as far as Singapore with smoke, but it also led to one of the warmest periods on record. Of course, it was also aided by El Nino, but peat fires, very, very serious. We had them in the Russian heat wave of 2010, too. The peat bogs all around Moscow and beyond were burning, and it was highly smoky and highly intensive carbon-releasing event.
Yes, there's a tremendous amount of carbon, you know, organic carbon within the peat and, you know, in the ground. And when that starts burning, you know, you have a huge problem. But also, you know, these fires have started so early this year in Canada, because sometimes, you know, when the fires start July and August, as long as they're not threatening infrastructure, they're just left to burn, because usually by the fall, you know, as temperature gets colder and there's more precipitation, the fires go out naturally. But, you know, they're starting in May and June, and, you know, if they don't put them out, they're going to burn all summer. So we're breaking all the records with the Canadian fires, and it's also happening in Siberia. You know, we've had record temperatures in Siberia and massive fires there, but we don't hear so much about those. But they are, you know, from satellite monitoring and other means, we can see they're producing tremendous amounts of smoke as well and burning up lots of the, they call it the taiga in Russia as opposed to boreal forest, but it's basically the same thing.
Let's move on to the extreme heat. Now, like the state of Florida, the government of Texas doesn't want to talk about climate change at all. They don't want to teach climate science in the schools. But it's amazing how that can happen, even as heat like nobody has ever seen just settles in for a long stay and punishes people there day after day. What do you know about this weird Texas heat dome?
Yes, so I have to get back to the jet streams because, so just a quick recap, I mean, they circumvent the Earth, and they exist because of the temperature difference, you know, the Arctic cold, the equator's warm. So that temperature difference sets up a pressure gradient, which then gets the winds going, and they get concentrated or focused into these narrow pathways, which we call the jet streams. And of course, as the Arctic is warming at much higher temperatures, you know, eight times the global average, and that temperature gradient to the equator is lowered, so the jet streams have to slow down. They slow down, they become wavier, and when you have very high peaks in the north-south direction of the jet stream, they tend to get stuck. Meteorologists call it kind of a blocking condition. And under a high-pressure area, there's very little rainfall, you know, very high temperatures, very few clouds. So it all contributes to making it hotter and hotter. So we have one of this heat dome over Texas is exactly that. The jet stream is kind of locked in this configuration where it stays hot there for, you know, extended periods of time, hot and very dry. I mean, I think they're reaching temperatures over 50 degrees Celsius there. And it's been ongoing, you know, over most of the last month.
Yep, 120 in the shade, as they would say in the United States. Paul, are we in the hottest time since humans, as we know ourselves, began?
Certainly, we're right up there. And I think this El Nino, which is just getting started, will push us to break all records by a large significant margin. We've had the cooling phase of the ENSO, the El Nino Southern Oscillation variability, and there's been a tremendous amount of heat that has been stored within the oceans as a result. And that heat is shallowing, and we're setting record temperatures by far in the North Atlantic, for example, off the UK. I believe it's 5 degrees Celsius warmer than normal, the oceans. And in the southern hemisphere around Antarctica, we're getting extremely warm sea surface temperatures, and we're getting warming of the water down below, which is increasing the melt rates, and the whole ocean circulation patterns seem to be shifting. So we're facing huge consequences from all these years where we've had more and more heat being trapped in the Earth system.
Lately, you have been widening your view. Tell us about your recent video called Vicious Accelerating Feedbacks Between Far-Right Politics and Climate Catastrophe.
Unfortunately, some of the things that occur as a result of accelerating climate change is, you know, there's areas of the planet which become less suitable to supporting human life. And as a result, we're seeing record amounts of people being displaced from their homelands, from their cities, or even from their countries. So there's migration, tremendous amounts of migration. These people have to go somewhere. And climate migrants, if you like, go to countries that have, you know, a bit of uncertainty in the political systems. And basically, if parties are on the left leaning, they tend to let in, you know, they tend to be more humanitarian in terms of we'll take these people, you know, as many people as we can, et cetera. And then the right-wing elements within the country and the political system say, hey, you know, wait a minute, we don't want all of these people taking jobs and taking resources, et cetera. We can't afford them. You know, they burden our system. So then there's a backlash against the immigrants. And a lot of these backlashes can lead to, you know, right-wing governments getting in. And then when the right-wing governments are in, then they basically get rid of the climate policies, what little there is. You know, then climate continues to worsen around the world when enough of this happens in countries. So there's all of these feedbacks. You know, we often talk about feedbacks, whether they be, you know, positive feedbacks, which are not positive. There's nothing good about them. They're accelerating the changes that happen. So you can think accelerating feedbacks, making things worse when you hear positive feedbacks. And then negative feedbacks, which, you know, cause a sort of slowing down of the changes. I mean, in the climate system, physically, we seem to be having mostly positive feedbacks, making things worse. But now we can talk about the feedbacks to humans and our actions and what we do. And a lot of these are positive feedbacks, which are accelerating the climate change problem. So you get in this sort of vicious loop, you know, where climate worsens and worsens, and there's more and more migration. And then there's more and more climate change as a result because a lot of the policies are just thrown away by the governments that come in. So there's all of these sort of things going on. And I think people in governments kind of get overwhelmed by all of the things that are happening so quickly. And as a result, poor decisions are made. They're all short-term decisions, you know, in-the-moment sort of things, knee-jerk reactions. And these things are not conducive to making any headways against climate change or any other issues for that matter, really.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian climate system scientist Paul Beckwith, returning with the big picture on the climate shift. You and I have talked at least a half dozen times about Arctic sea ice, one of your specialties. What is the latest?
Yes, there's always a lot happening in the Arctic. And, you know, often the sea ice is talked about, which we'll do that again. But let's not forget the snow cover in the Arctic in the spring, because basically, the Arctic is getting a lot darker because of we're losing the sea ice. We're also losing the snow cover in the spring. And a darker Arctic absorbs more energy, and that increases the temperature amplification in the Arctic compared to the rest of the planet, which then, you know, has that huge effect I've already discussed on slowing the jet streams. So a paper came out just recently that actually tried to really kind of get a handle on, you know, when we can expect the Arctic sea ice to essentially vanish. One summer, you know, one mid-September in the not-too-distant future, we're going to have what I call the Blue Ocean event, where there's very little sea ice left at the end of the summer melt season. Usually it's defined as less than a million square kilometers. So the date of that happening, in the IPCC, the last version, the Assessment Report 6, they came to the conclusion from papers that, yes, in intermediate and high emission scenarios, we would completely lose the Arctic sea ice, but not before 2050, 2060 even. And in the low emission scenarios, we'd never lose it. So this new paper, it looked at the CMIP-6 modeling, all of these different models to model sea ice, and it found that they weren't really even, if you run them backwards, they weren't matching up to the observations. You know, what they did in this paper was a very simple concept. They took the CMIP-6 models, the most sophisticated computer models on sea ice, they ran them backwards, they found that they were way too high, way much higher than the observations. So they then forced the models by scaling factors to match the observations in the past, and then they ran them forward using those same scaling factors, and they found that the sea ice would vanish under all emission scenarios, including the low emission scenario, and under the intermediate and high emission scenarios, it could vanish as early as the late 2030s. So they basically moved the vanishing date likelihood up by over a decade, from 2050s to late 2030s. So basically that's it. It was a very simple idea. But, I mean, combining the sophisticated models with the observations, so they're all self-consistent, they got a more realistic picture. I think it's still a bit conservative. Yeah, I think it will happen sooner. Some people are saying, you know, we could have this blue ocean event during this phase of the El Nino. If we have a super El Nino, it looks like we might be heading that way. And also, you know, if you look at the heat going into the Arctic from the atmosphere, also from the oceans, sea surface temperatures and the currents underneath the ocean, you can see that these things are all, you know, attacking and reducing sea ice. And what's also happening at the same time is the same thing is happening to Antarctica. I mean, for decades there, Antarctica sea ice was pretty stable. It actually was increasing, I think, about 1.5% per decade or something. But it's dropped off a cliff in the last decade or so, and it's setting record lows. And we're not talking about just a record low. We're talking about many, many standard deviations below anything that's in the records. So this is happening in Antarctica as well, which is very concerning.
Another underestimated stress point is simply having enough food for over 8 billion people. So I watched your video called Wheat Yields in the USA and China Threatened by Heat Waves Breaking Enzymes. What is that about?
Yes, well, over the years, people have been working trying to make crops more heat resistant. It's interesting because, you know, we had the so-called Green Revolution where we were able to double and then double again and double again for many different doubling periods, the yields, the amount of food that we could get in terms of, you know, whether it be maize like the corns or wheats or grains. We greatly improved yields per hectare. We didn't increase farmland that much, but we increased the amount of food that we could grow, and we improved farming techniques and so on, you know, drip irrigation, more places being irrigated, the fertilizers, which are fossil fuel derived, of course. But we're reaching a limit. I mean, like any other plant, you can reach a limit, and the temperature can actually be so warm that the crop itself just can no longer tolerate it. It just can't grow. It's just too hot. It desiccates, and the protein molecules, you know, when you cook an egg, what you're basically doing is you're getting denaturation of the protein bonds in the egg. I mean, enzymes are biological catalysts. They're very important for chemical reactions in the living plant or living animal. So there's lots of enzymes at work. And these enzymes just break down. They lose their properties. They're no longer able to function as enzymes when the temperature gets too high. The yields plummet when that sort of thing happens. So we're reaching temperatures, you know, in many, many wheat-producing areas where that can happen. So yields aren't just going to drop slowly. You reach, it's a threshold, another one of these threshold things, nonlinear processes, where you're okay to a certain point, and then suddenly the yield will collapse.
Now, Germany is building 10 new ports to import liquefied natural gas. Vietnam is counting on LNG. Country after country says they are going with gas. They say gas is greener, but it is all just methane, really, the same methane you have been warning about for over a decade. Paul, how do you feel about a world powered by methane?
Methane was touted as, a bridge fuel. And, you know, the term natural gas, right? I mean, some marketing genius said, hey, let's call the methane natural gas, and we can heat our homes with natural gas. I mean, natural gas sounds great. It's natural, right? Unfortunately, you know, it's a very potent greenhouse gas, you know, has an enormous global warming potential compared to CO2. And a lot of it, since 2010, we're getting a lot more of it being produced from the wetlands around the planet, you know, as the wetlands are heating and drying or rainfall patterns change. So people are counting on natural gas, and in order to transport it, it's very difficult to transport a gas in volume. You know, oil is perfect, right? As a liquid, it's easily transportable. Basically, natural gas is a gas, of course, and they cool it down until it's liquefied. So they have to keep it at very, very low temperatures and transport it that way. So it's very expensive and very bulky to do. But, you know, some countries, are going that way. I mean, we're burning more and more fossil fuels than ever on this planet. I mean, the world goes through about 100 million barrels per day. And we also go through about 60 million barrel equivalents per day of so-called natural gas / methane. It's all increasing. And anytime you use methane and you have a leak rate, if you have a leak rate of the methane into the atmosphere from your pipelines of 1 or 2%, then you could argue, well, methane, when you burn it, it's cleaner burning, it produces less CO2. But if there's, I mean, we're not experiencing leak rates that low. We're experiencing leak rates 5 to 10% on most pipelines and systems, and therefore methane is worse than or just as bad as burning coal in terms of the effect on climate with very, very high leak rates. So it's no solution at all. It's just extending the problem.
I totally agree. Now, moving on to AI, papers already credit machine learning or deep learning. Do you think artificial intelligence will help humans understand climate and the real-life systems we live in?
That's sort of a hope. I mean, of course, AI, there's loads of opposing views on AI. It's going to destroy humanity all the way to it's going to save humanity. It's going to solve, you know, some of the issues like climate change that we haven't even been able to make any sort of dent in, because basically our entire society is predicated on burning fossil fuels. I think if scientists start to incorporate AI into their, you know, their thinking on, you know, if you're looking at climate solutions, if you're looking how to make, say, cement that doesn't emit CO2, or if you're looking at phytoplankton in the ocean to capture carbon, or growing things like kelp, you know, having kelp farms or things like that, I think AI could be used as a tool to do a lot of simulations that might save you from making mistakes, and, you know, might help identify which technologies can have the most promise and things like that. So it's very double-edged, like any other technology. But, I mean, we haven't talked about the James Hansen paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline, yet. He's working on another one, Global Sea Level Rise in the Pipeline. He's also working on his book, Sophie's Planet, which I'm hoping is sort of like an updated version of Storms of Our Grandchildren. But we basically we're really running out of time very fast to try to stabilize our climate system. Well, Hansen's, ever since he testified in Congress in, 1988 or something, he's been trying to raise alarm bells about climate, and we haven't. You know, I mean, just look at greenhouse gas levels over time and plot the dates of all the climate conferences on that graph, and we're nowhere near addressing this issue, this problem.
So how can we find out more about Hansen's work?
I did a video summary of it. It's a very technical paper. There's a lot in there. I'll revisit it soon. I'm going to try to create some video shorts, and I'm going to make a debut on, here's a commitment, I'm going to make a debut on TikTok. I'm going to try to do some videos on TikTok with just some of the key points of Hansen's findings, right? I'm just trying to figure out ways to get the message out more because it's very important. But in a nutshell, if you look from 2010 back to the late 70s, 80s, you know, over that time period, our planet was warming about 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade. Now, look at what happens after 2010. Basically, the warming rate has upticked significantly, it looks like, but it's still too early to know for sure. But Hansen's been arguing that the warming rate has notched upwards, and it's notched upwards between 50 and 100%. So he draws two curves, and we're somewhere probably in between them, according to Hansen's latest paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline. So I said it was 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade rise since up to 2010. Since 2010, it's 0.27 degrees Celsius per decade up to 0.36 degrees Celsius per decade. So that's either a 50% increase or 100% increase. And there's lots of reasons for this. One of the big reasons is that the Earth energy imbalance has greatly increased. If there was no imbalance, the Earth would be stable temperature overall, the whole system. But, you know, as long as the Earth energy imbalance is positive, then you're going to get warming. And the higher it is, the more warming you're going to get. And one of the big factors, it looks like, is that we've had a reduction of aerosols over the ocean specifically since 2015. And an even bigger reduction in 2020 of these. It's basically marine fuels have sulfur in them, and the requirements on the amount of sulfur have been tightened significantly in 2015 by the International Maritime Organization, and also in 2020 they were tightened again. Now, over the oceans, there's very few aerosols because the sources are mostly man-generated. Some over the ocean, like from plankton, the dimethyl sulfide, a few other things. But most of the aerosol, it's pretty clean environment in the air over the oceans. So any ships crisscrossing the ocean would put up these aerosols from their smokestacks, and they would, it's not just ones you could see, but they would spread far and wide, and they would cause a huge cooling of those regions of the ocean. So we're not getting that to the same extent now. And this could be another reason why we're seeing extremely high ocean temperatures, and they happen to coincide for the most part with areas of very, very high shipping. So I think there's a direct relationship going on here, but this needs to be confirmed by peer-reviewed science, which, you know, it's too early for that to have been done. But I think that might be one reason why the ocean temperatures are going crazy right now.
Well, we're out of time, and we're out of time in this interview, unfortunately. From Ottawa, we've been talking with the climate system scientist and science communicator Paul Beckwith. You can find links to the videos we talked about and all Paul's work in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and you can learn the facts of climate change by searching for Paul H. Beckwith on YouTube. It's like a free university for everybody, and the science comes out in real time as it's published. Paul, thank you for your work and working for us all, really.
Well, thank you so much, Alex. And, you know, I have to give you a big shout out and thank you to your work over the years with Radio EcoShock. It's, you know, we're all trying to do our bit, right? Because we understand, you know, what's going on with the climate systems.
Yes, we love life and we know that big trouble is coming, so we should try and change. I'm Alex Smith. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org.
I've got to change this thing. Is it way too crazy? Way too hot? Normal is what she's not.